Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
And now for Paul. Paul Hoover is the author of 7 collections of poems. Among them, Totem and Shadow, New and Selected Poems, which was published last year by Talisman House. His book, Viridian, won the University of Georgia Press's Contemporary Poetry Competition and was published in 1997. The witty and amazingly inventive book-length poem called The Novel was published by New Directions in 1990. Robert Creeley wrote in this extraordinary book, "Powers of saying are raised to the nth." No fewer than 7 of Paul's poems have been published in the prestigious annual series, The Best American Poetry, edited by David Lehman. A novel, which, by the way, called Saigon, Illinois, concerns his experience working as a conscientious objector in one of Chicago's hospitals during the Vietnam War. And it was the springboard for the poem, the novel, a full-length poem, which works in many ways around the subject of the novelist, in a sense, as opposed to the poet, as everybody, you know, the high and mighty novelist. As everybody knows, if you want to call up a poet to have him come and give a reading, you usually get him on the telephone, but if it's a big, powerful novelist, you have to go through his agent. There are very few poets that have agents. Paul, of course, is poet in residence at Columbia College and editor of the widely used Norton Anthology of Postmodern American Poetry, and I'd like to ask you how long it took you to put that together. That's quite a feat. Yeah, something like that. It's amazing. He, too, has read his poems and taken part in conferences in many places, including the University of Liège in Belgium, for example, and both Paul and Max will read their work, and Paul will teach at a conference next summer in St. Petersburg, Russia. How's that? Okay, Paul.
Thanks very much, Mark. It's really great to be reading at the Poetry Center. I have many memories. Hi, Barry. Many memories of our meetings at in your living room and in our living room and in Liesl Mueller's and Martha Friedberg's and so on, of establishing the Poetry Center and hoping it would survive, and look what's happened. Now we're in this gorgeous room. We also have many tales to tell about the misbehavior of various... Well, never mind. I want to start by reading a poem from Totem and Shadow. It's from the new section of the poems. And I want to read it because it mentions my dad. In which city? I chose that title because it was from a blurb that Douglas Messerly wrote for a Susan Howe book. And he says, something like Baltimore, in which city she lived for so many years. So I always pick the most exciting parts. In which city? Radiant darkness, collapsing light, the full catastrophe blurred, tunnels under worlds, another lifeboat scene, the present absent felt like minds named things. In sequences like smoke, in deadbolt light, your father's back is turned against the camera as he faces that field. Words and silence are uttered like a surface, porous but smooth. Like when your daughter's friend says she must decide between her father and lover. Haven't you purely places in the leaves? Falling too darkly toward that mouth, trembling like a... note by note, were mastered by the shape each wave makes, since what rises rarely falls, exactly as the getting. Like an anvil on the table teetering toward the brink, the language of height breaks with weight. Each act is magic, black as space, moral darkness, anonymous rot. You live transparent. The ghost of a chance, the light inch spreads to enter its name. Well, these poems are written in a form. There are four words per stanza. It's called counted verse. Instead of counting syllables, you count the number of words that will appear in each line. So this is 2x2. So it has a little bit of a pinch on it, a little bit of pressure that sort of drives it forward. And so you're paying attention to the making of the poem, and you're really not thinking about your subject matter, and therefore your subject matter goes more smoothly. It proceeds more smoothly, without you, I guess you could say. Unfortunately, my dad died this summer, and so that's why I started reading a poem about him. So here's a poem that I wrote after he passed away. It's called Conjure. Conjure, to bring forth, right, to summon. It has a epigraph, a quote before, from Paulo Leminski, the Brazilian poet, the father of new things. Father of dirt in your new white gown, you're senseless of your fall and even these words. Existential now, proto-historic, you live in the vestige. The father of occasion is fatherless realm. At liberty and no mirror, your province is vast. Having lived is natural enough. All flesh weeps. Time's last indiscretion will not be retracted. Even the wind complains, ungainly and apparent. Resident of earth, come from your remnants to the 18th site. Father of logic and speed and bone, here's a heap of sticks you'll need to interpret. You're altogether underworldly. Come with breath in your last note. Come with pleasure on your mouth and tongue. Father of plans and meticulous acts, there is no likeness in idiom and earth. I don't have anything funny. I don't think I have it. This is Winter Mirror. Put the mirror up to winter, you know, right? Put the mirror up to nature. I'm not depressed or anything. It's just that that's the way it... it's just the way it happened. That's the way it is. Winter Mirror. When the windows are silent and thin as language, snow falls into rifts and valleys. See, the more you live in California, the more you think of snow. Everything changes. Even the trees cease their breathing in the smooth night air. The one world turns. As the hand draws aside its exponential curtain, the only no spoken, the length of the sequence, creaks in the mind. The temper of water waiting for its shape in the unrelenting rush of things in their freezing. The vacant shuttle returning to earth, its voices heard on last year's tapes, these signs also lurching out to history, where the unnerved god sleeps on its back. In that secret place, one simple branch, strict with attention, lashes at your eye. Thank appetite for heaven, and also the singing's late green leaves, thin in the flurry, where the deepest houses sink and bright smoke rises. Not this, and not that, not even winter asking what you're after on a brief afternoon, which of course is pale in the cold porch light. To be without speech, the solitary staging, a touch after dying or breath in its harness, turning and turning. There is nothing the sun cannot explain, nothing too clear for ice of mind, steeped in its season like body and desire, tree and belief. Now, it's kind of funny, you know, the poems don't seem to have any story to it, but they seem to have a steady purpose. You know, I, you don't really have to do that. You can find a course through the words. American Ruins. I always thought I wanted to do a book on American ruins. Because, you know, there's such a promise of the New Republic. You remember that Whitman-esque business? Right? The glory of the rising republic and the great liberal democracy and all that. And now at this stage of history, we look back and we see the possibility of ruins. You know, we're very forward-looking, very positive people and all that, but we do see the possibility of ruins, American ruins. But anyway, so I wanted to do a prose book about ruins, but I settled for this poem instead. That's a true sign of a poet. You know, you could write a prose book, but heck, I'll write a poem instead. Dumbed down but handsome, a storm makes its way through the spark of power lines and its own roar. A car filled with dogs passes on your right, makes the turn, hits the ditch, but continues on its journey. The general sense of things converging has never been less, yet meanings not undone by the junction of two roads. Other newer things are the world as you found it, pricked by the heat, the dustbin of theory, and a sudden death of story. You can hear a map unfolding like days of rain, the gush of metal in a trailer park, one thick tree absent from its station, and stands of flowers touched by nothing but their own cheap scent. The kitchen creaks. Stillness is complete. Traced in its remains, rain is also written on the lake and shore, on a contract drawn briefly from its sleeve, on 9 wide miles of riven space. The mine's green debris and Turtle Creek are packed with silt and partygoers. As deer knows south, the dullest of facts speaks to its zenith with miraculous gestures the swifts pour from. Around the burning house, a normal gray day is intense with indifference. You spend all day tying what's not this to what's not that, yet swallows still turn nearly transparent in the damp summer's mouth. Flash back flat to fill your eye. The shadow of a hand stands for desire in the nothing sun. Love is form, a life so sweet decay cannot conceive. Rumors of rumors and layers of belief. When the gods are German at their rival fires, the language fact in its weaving and bending is a self-northwest, if not to say central. At the intersection of time and vine, rock rhymes sky in shape and displacement, but the words won't come for lack of science, because the field is full and the town quite empty, you gape at the leaves and windows, acting just like leaves. This one has a little more cultural flavor, color, like it's more in present tense, you know, where you can recognize the social environment. You know, you're not buried in some, you know, leaves. You know, you got your nose down in some leaves. It's called Polyester. Verbless in eternity, the city is a screenplay where you can hear the voice of distance singing Funky Town. And it's like a fish grasping the concept of heaven, an upright infinity where everything's all. The tactile world collapses on closer inspection. Light exhausts itself on the brazen face of shadow. In the thickness of time, each world is a reading undernourished by its simulacra, a carpeted heartland miraculous and banal. You watch the new decay at every turn corner, but I is not the I, this one, and you are not the you, Y-E-W, anti-prophetic with a shining smile. As you fade into the real, pleasure is hormonal and the concept of wonder more or less fluorescent. the narcissistic object finds its mirror soaked with attention. That Polaroid of the sun cooling in your hand is a certainty and a fact, kissing your eye in a semi-ecstatic doubt that says the man is a rat, the rat's a star. I was issued a challenge the last time I read that poem. And somebody asked me if I didn't want to prove the ending. And thought I had made some serious error, you know. How can the man be a rat and the rat be a star? And it's all very confusing. And so we had a discussion about it, kind of workshop-type discussion. Would anybody like to discuss? And then I realized that possibly she didn't recognize that there was a kind of anagram relation between star and rats, right? That they have the same letters. So I was very proud. I put her down severely. No, not really. This is a different form that I've been practicing. It has longer lines. It's called O and Green. Size without design, past without a history, at what height midday enters, swinging its gate, and this much later, presented in language, not in perception, the field's white design, an old bone sequence, contemplation's edge planned as a texture, we are playing a game of appearance, the what world leaks on the language hand, to say another and mean knife among the pub crawlers, emotional voices, hands in water, eyeless spies of a discontent evening, the warm mind shrouded, humorous and astute rumors we carried. Who cannot endure silence or sighs, infinity's brief articulation? Each curve of the water redesigns light, bends seeing briefly. In which pattern, deepening the background, the fourth eye canters. A footprint goes straight to these windows, sand-blown, sand city, along the coast, restless. In California, if you're driving down to Santa Cruz and beyond toward Monterey, and you take Highway 1, which is recommended, it's wonder, you know, it's very beautiful, and it's also sort of desolate. You know, beauty and desolation they're sort of close often, and the kind of lonesomeness of it. You pass the. What am I talking about? Oh, thank you. And along the way, I was thinking that I just got lost in my little travel. Along the way, you pass a lighthouse, which is very beautiful, and it looks like a good place to go swimming, until you find out it's the world's largest breeding ground for great white sharks. Anyway, somewhere down there, there's a town called Sand City. And I took my kids all the way down to see the great aquarium they have down by Santa Cruz. Monterey, thank you. Maxine, I got back from Chicago, and Maxine said, you should take the kids on a trip. So I don't fish or anything. You know, I didn't pack up the fishing gear. We drove down to Monterey. It's a long trip. We wound up having to stay overnight in Sand City. And this is an amazing place. I mean, you have the feeling you might wake up in the morning and you've been covered by sand. It's like the dunes are shifting. The wind is whipping. Your car is stung in the morning, you know, wincing from the beating it's taken. And sand-blown Sand City along the coast, restless. So take the trip, I guess. Now, this is The Prolific and the Devourer. I read a book by W.H. Auden. It was Youthful Writings. He had some kind of system he was trying to work out based on Blake's concept of the prolific and the devourer. That's which is productive and that's which consumes. Right? You have to have something to eat that which is produced, right? And that these two yin-yang forces are in some kind of a constant struggle in eternity. Well, he made it about 50 pages. And it just fell apart. The whole system fell apart. But it's a nice little book to read, and it has some really wonderful wit about his own upbringing. That has nothing to do with the poem. The poem's called The Prolific and the Devourer. In Aphorisms of Summer, the sleek cat stretches in prolific wonder. Mr. and Mrs. Popcorn and the audience roar, and all the dirt of history falls once more between pornography and story. We are free only to deny our freedom, said the Nietzschean in pants. But it is exactly wrong to stand in the transcendent as in the blankness of the field. It has been decided, and not by the committee, that people are real, but events themselves are radiant with error. We experience them as through a glass curtain. To feel excited by the subject of mining, to cover the body at night with a series of heavy drapes or the painting from a wall, are a kind of perfection. Perfection, which always finds a corner on which to blame its doubt, shame and disgust at its own vocation, and pride in its love affairs. There is always a patient obligation waiting to instill the dust of remoteness in a necessary head. The eye is open wide to the schlock of the new, as if the old cared. The nervous strike their confident poses. In the darkness of a room, with the logic of a body, keep the tongue private, the tongue in its nest. Exhausted by belief, it is a true believer, and even to name it a primitive act. The gods have been gentle in their naked resemblance. We have seen them wavering at the source of the city. In the phantom camp, at the far edge of the stone pond, the wind is dressed for a later arrival. The family is eager to achieve closure, one says after a murder, to put away horror in a second mind, to reenact nothing that is not finally pleasure, is modern and reptilian. But the first mind remembers the flash stone field. I didn't check the time, but I'll just go ahead. I have a plan. This is a poem in a form. I thought that I wanted to write a ballad, which is quatrains A B C B and 4-3-4-3 and all that. Didn't work out, but I wound up with an A B C B quatrain poem, and here it is. Very untypical for me, I think. The Innocent Eye. A string of Chinese lights on a bridge in darkness is a large nerve net suggesting your apartness. As a character in a novel consisting of two gestures, a heart that easily stirs, a mind that nobly festers, between its fall and ascension, offering only questions instead of certain knowledge, in other words, testing the shadow in its object, body and monotonous soul. Even when asleep, your business is thinking, straw into gold. The narrative is constructed from being, time, and sweat, slavishness and a certain grandeur, nostalgia in a breath, while poetry is the playing of an almost secret music, gestures in winter darkness for the living and the quick. The innocent eye sees nothing but its own seeing act, performing its ritual errors with patience and tact. You're the copy and the model, absence exhausted by presence. As you trace the going of each small death, a fog of prescience settles on the mind. The story ends exactly as it started, with a season always winter and meaning on its guard. A person made of words lives in a garden of stones. Immensities of time and space collapse around the known. Because the world is meant, words are what we know. The darkest sounds are songs, the broken and the thrown. I think I'll read two more poems. And I want to do one. I understand music not a bit. In other words, I know nothing of the structures of music. And, I listen to John Coltrane, and I'm sure it's like, some sort of sheep listening, to a string quartet. It's like, right? But, I try to listen in. I try to get inside the music. And I wrote a couple of poems that are about listening to music. Of course, this is called Naima, which is a Coltrane title. Scoured by sound and the scent of distance, we breathe the different airs song long to be. South of glimpsed, a stopwatch tune, dream movie lips in silk and space. It moves me so, in a plain white shirt, wet with physics of the downpouring rain. Tangent to the world, spread as dead, the voices overheard in thin Tunisian air. Dub of ghosts, even with speech, and yet just song. Tongues buzz, adamant glass, the third note blown, lifted from its growl. Language as skin and the glass of seeming. In October light, empty as the coast, your new muse stirs, its old names stitched in apostrophic smoke. Like a driver on ice careening into control, eyes wide shut. It's like they say, the more you watch the cat, the more abstract it gets, sitting in its bowl. But no green wave on a stark afternoon is quite taken back. Raked with dew, the fugitive world relapses into fact. Sweet to be released in wood and stone, a code unknown except for insistence. The precipice and the rift akin to thinking. Who or what stands on name's last ledge where the poignant chorus sways in bewildered prose? Freaked with meaning, maybe ghost knows. Okay, well, I want to end by reading my big Gonzo cento. Are you acquainted with the form of the cento? Okay, a cento is the word for 100. And it's everything, every line in this poem is stolen from another author. There's not one original line in the whole poem. And that's what a cento is. You pinch off little bits and put them together and you get your own poem. Cut and paste. I need to get a drink before I start this. It was really dry. It's called American Gestures. And it has a quote from the French poet Jacques Ribaud, "Poetry is the memory of language." There is one story and one story only, one luminary clock against the sky. I remember it was in the bleak December. I wandered in the forest thoughtlessly, where love is a word, another kind of open, and innocence is a weapon. I think of cinemas, panoramic slates black at their centers. They have come along nicely under the separated leaves of shade, near the snow, near the sun, in the highest fields, and then to awake like a wanderer white. I wish that I had spoken only of it all and put a sign up closed to all but me. I know why the caged bird sings, whacka whacka, howler, right? Back in the human mind again, and thereupon my heart is driven wild with the noise of winds and many rivers. When it comes, the landscape listens, and we are here as on a darkling plain, fantastic with mythic trophies. A green thought in a green shade, a Chippendale in a domino's étude, mute, insensate things. They are all gone into the world of light. All things within this fading world hath end. Tell her that wastes her time and me, your mouth opens neat as a cat's. The window square raises a remote confessing head, rich with entropy, nevertheless separable, noticeable. It was too much, Mike says, who enticed my father from my mother's bed. Too late now, I make out in his blue gaze, in the quite ordinary heat of the day, an erotic mixture of self-denial and fear. Though it is not yet evening, the trees are coming into leaf, the eyes open to a cry of pulleys, and yesterday's garbage ripens in the hall. The high meridian of the day is past, in a different form beyond any meaning. Clay is the word, and clay is the flesh. Oh, for a bowl of fat canary, nature's true riches and sweet beauty showing. We're all's accustomed, ceremonious, and I left my necktie God knows where. Then I can write a washing bill in Babylonic cuneiform from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. To wash the spot, to burn the snare and the full moon and the white evening star is pure acceptance, sprouting alike in broad zones and in narrow zones like the distant Latin chanting of a train. Because there is a literal shore, a letter that's blood red, draped with material turning white in the sun, the wounds are terrible, the paint is old. Then a house disappears, and a man in his yard counts the stars and those of plum color. This drizzle that falls now is American rain, in which the woman I left was sleeping. Behind closed windows blankening with steam, the rooms and days we wandered through into that dark permanence of ancient forms. A minute holds them who have come to go, the night watchman in a perfume factory, an old man hammering in a doll shop whose thoughts are summer lightning. It is only an isolate flex that something is given off. When a kid puts on a wedding dress in the darkness of a closet, his beauty defies all kisses, seasons, and moves with an uncertain violence among the tentative haunters. Children, if you dare to think and converse with sweet women long since dead, know that the mind of man creates no ideas. I think of you as I descend the stairs where the lower and higher have ending, and I shall stand here like a shadow. The imagination that we spurned and crave, a mound of refuse of the sweeping of a street, shows only when the daylight falls. But in the flesh it is immortal. With witness I speak this. But where I say dark house by which once more I stand, I mean a lonely impulse of delight between Muskogee and Tulsa and the bamboo that speaks as if weeping toko tiko tokati, toko tiko tokati. This is the valley's work, the white, the shining, horsemen of the wild party at the Elks Club Lounge. I am slow, thinking in broken images, but often I am allowed these messages, like wrinkles on some mad forehead, the thousand eyelids of the sleeping water. Under the poinciana of a noon or afternoon where the great pattern dozes, trinket, apotheosis, and mollusk. This is a dead scene forever now. I am because my little dog knows me. All right, thank you.